Podcasting from Alexandria, Virginia, just a few miles from Washington, D.C., where we all hope doing what is right the first time is everyone's top priority. This is Software Quality Today, presented by TX3 Services, where we empower life science companies to digitally transform their software testing. This is a podcast for industry professionals about the trends and challenges of software quality testing, computerized systems validation, and the people who are leading the way. We'll be providing you with interviews from special guests as well as news from thought leaders at leading life sciences organizations and vendors alike. And now, here's your host, CSV expert and VP of Strategic Solutions at TX3 Services, Dori Gonzalez-Azevedo.
Welcome to another episode of Software Quality Today, presented by TX3 Services. I'm your host, Dori Gonzalez-Azevedo. Today, I'll be interviewing my friend, colleague, and fellow entrepreneur, Mike Fannin, president and founder of BioIT Solutions. BioIT Solutions specializes in advanced computational workflow and data management systems for biotechnology research, clinical diagnostics, drug development, and translational medicine. Mike is the designer and architect of BioIT's One Platform 4 software that enables BioIT to deliver sophisticated, purpose-built, multi-user database systems at a fraction of the time and cost of traditional software delivery. Mike has served as part-time CIO and advisor of several early-stage biotech companies. Prior to starting BioIT Solutions in 2006, Mike was director of bioinformatics, then VP and chief information officer of Human Genome Sciences. This is where I first met Mike and his team when the need to validate the custom solutions that they were creating were required. At Human Genome Sciences, he directed pioneering work in the systematic analysis of human genes to identify promising medical applications. Mike also managed HGS's high-volume sequencing operations, including sample preparation, sequencing, sample tracking, data capture, data analysis, and management of Human Genome's vast inventory of biological materials. Mike was CIO during HGS's explosive growth and expansion into drug manufacturing and clinical trials, which was subsequently purchased in 2012 by GSK for $3.6 billion. Mike graduated from Rollins College with an honors BA in physics and earned an MBA in operations research from the American University. He currently serves on the board of directors of Microbiome Insights in Vancouver, Canada, and has been a trustee for Rollins College and Barry School. In today's conversation, we explore a brief history of his experience of how a startup blended data and DNA to revolutionize the biotech industry, his philosophy of data being an asset rather than an expense, and how his team helps their customers rethink business processes to find a new, better way of working, and how they adopt a position of not knowing requirements to lead to more robust solutions. Enjoy my conversation today with Mike Fannin. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hey, Dori, I'm doing well. Good to see you.
It is nice to see you. And it's unfortunate that it's been so long since I've been able to see you in person, but I've missed our lunch dates and chatting.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I actually went to visit a customer this week, or a potential customer anyway, a lead, a prospect, and it felt great.
That's nice. That's nice.
Although I was definitely rusty in front of a crowd.
Right? It's kind of, I'll have a happy hour with my team next week out in San Francisco. And I haven't been out in public in a long time.
Wow.
It's very, very exciting. So I'm so happy to be able to introduce you to our audience today and to have this chat. Mike, we've known each other now for a while, and
Yes, we have.
I'm been very blessed to have and feel confident to be able to call you one of my mentors, and I really feel like you've been that for me over the years and helped me with my business, helped me with my strategy, helped me with just continuing to help my education in this space. And so I want to thank you for all of that. And thank you for your time today.
Oh, well, that's very thoughtful. And certainly I've always been eager to follow your success as well. You've done such a great job.
So today I thought we would kind of get into some really interesting topics. But first I want to give everyone kind of an idea of who you are and what you are. So I'm going to open up the floor for you to kind of tell us who you are and how you came to be in this unique space that we call software quality.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So my career has been a little circuitous, as is true with many people. So I'll go back to my college days. I got an honors Bachelor of Arts in Physics from Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida. And at the time, there really weren't any computer science programs. Maybe some of the major universities were just starting to roll those out. But at the time, it was more or less a hobby that I picked up to develop and do some computer programming. And I really enjoyed it. So it was used partially in my research as a physicist, because we had a lot of data reduction kinds of tasks. And so it was natural to learn a little bit of programming. And so when I graduated, I actually sought a position as a programmer and a software engineer. And I was also a bit of an entrepreneur in college as well, because essentially without a computer science professor, the seniors ran the data center for the college. So it was interesting. And I also got some jobs on the side because it was a rare skill in those days. So there was a local businessman who was just tinkering with Monte Carlo simulations for business outcomes and whatnot. And I look back on that, and that was really progressive for the time. I was just doing what he asked me to do.
Right.
But so I actually developed this affinity for, one, doing the programming, and two, kind of being like an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I was successful at kind of helping, make a little bit of money on the side doing this. And so then I sought, a career in computer programming, and ended up with Martin Marietta, which is now Lockheed Martin in Orlando, Florida. And then they moved me to the headquarters up here in Maryland. And so 1983 was the year that my wife and I moved up here. And we both worked for Martin Marietta at the time. So I went from this Fortune 500 company, who also then put me through MBA school at American University as a night student. So I was working full-time and going to American U for night classes, basically. So I basically got the grounding in the Fortune 100 company and how do big companies make decisions and what that feel like in government contracting, as well as just, what was going on in the large-scale data systems kind of world. Again, predominantly government contracting, but we did some other commercial work as well. After getting my MBA, though, I was really eager to start a business. And so in 1990, I started a business. And I don't know if I've told you this story, but my oldest daughter at the time was 6 weeks old.
Mm.
And I go to Michelle, my wife, and say, "Hey, honey, I want to quit my job at a Fortune 100 company."
Every time,
and
every wife
start
wants
a
to hear
business.
That, yeah.
And so I'm attributing this, and she kind of was, "Sure, honey, go ahead, whatever you want." And I was a little bit taken aback, but it was clearly either the hormones or the sleep deprivation or both of having a newborn in the house. So that was a real, it looks like in retrospect, a brave move. It just seemed to make sense to me. And my first customer was a biotech company called Microbiological Associates here in Rockville, Maryland. And that relationship was really great. So we took an assay that they were doing, it's an ELISA assay, and did a little bit of laboratory automation work for them, created an order entry system, customer samples come in, array them on plates, run them through a plate reader. I did the plate reader integration. And then at the time, we used a facsimile server to send preliminary results to the customers. We reduced the turnaround time. We allowed them to essentially triple the business without adding lab staff, because the old process was so manual and so laborious. And that was this great experience, because we're starting to see biotech using instruments that can collect data at pretty substantial quantities. And the people just really didn't have the background that I was seeing in certain other industrial contexts for being able to put together a system to do that. And we found that was a great stepping stone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so roll forward a little bit. Those of you that are old enough might remember the Ebola scare back in the late 80s, where Hasseltine Labs here in Virginia had monkeys that carried the Ebola virus, and it was a big scare. And there were some books about this, both fiction and nonfiction, about that incident. So this laboratory that we developed, we quickly pivoted. We were the first in the U.S. to offer a test that quarantined monkeys could take so that we could clear them for studies in the U.S. And so, that was my introduction to biotechnology, and I've never looked back. We've been doing biotech work forever. The president of Microbiological Associates left the company, and his next job was the chief financial officer and first employee of a company called Human Genome Sciences.
Yes, where I met you.
Exactly.
Which the journey begins, yes.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I like to tell people that I didn't know how to spell DNA when I started with HGS, right? But it was remarkable that biology was being reduced to information, the sequence of characters. And I, you know, as an IT guy, by that time, I recognized that, hey, an ACT or G can be represented by two bits, right? What is this involved? And it's all pattern matching. And it was actually a very familiar way to work my way into biotech because of DNA as a technique for transferring information. And if you look at the way genes are expressed and you line that up, and I did this in some early presentations with what the old Ethernet spec looked like about what a header looks like and a tail and the part in the middle. This is exactly what we had. We had the primers at the beginning and a certain stretch of the RNA that we were looking for at the time, and then the variable part, essentially the packet of information being transferred.
Right.
I mean, and the analogies between what we were doing virtually. So it was the kind of thing that lended itself to computerization extremely well. And we started doing virtual experiments, right? Things like isolating genes and identifying pattern matching and finding similarities and whatnot.
Yeah.
So that was a fabulous experience. And then once I had been established in that business and HGS grew a bit, the head of our gene discovery group actually moved on and I applied for the job. And so I actually became both the head of bioinformatics at the time and the head of the gene discovery group. And in HGS lingo, that means that's the group that did the tissue acquisition and the high throughput sequencing at the time. So it was very interesting to be able to essentially move from an IT position into more of a line management position.
Yeah.
And as a result, I became kind of the customer facing executive for all of the deals that we did in selling genomes to pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. So fabulous, fabulous experience over the course of about a dozen years or so I was there.
And wonderful people, right? So one of the things that if people ask me often is, you know, what are some highlights of your career? And I said, that short year that I was at Human Genome Sciences was the best year. The amount of talent and people and the things that were being done and developed was just extraordinary. And some of them are still best friends today, which I know you have as well, right?
Yes, yes. And so HGS then got essentially grew beyond research and started actually identifying drug candidates. We built a factory, we built QA labs, we conducted clinical trials, we installed clinical trial management systems. So there was this enormous explosion. We had grown to over 1,000 people. So when I started with the company as a consultant, there were 3 employees, and we grew to well over 1,000 people. And this was in an 8-year span. At the time we reached our max, we actually occupied 16 different buildings with about a 2-mile radius. So,
it's a phenomenal story. Yeah. I mean, someone, I'm surprised someone hasn't written a book yet about it, because it really is. Yeah. It's a very, from a business perspective, but also the booming technology perspective, there's a combination there that I think there's a story to be told and to share with the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what an experience to be on the ground floor here as this, essentially this new industry, not just a new company, was emerging. And we got involved with patenting of human genes. So that was an area that we put a lot of investment in and a lot of information system crunching into doing some things to streamline and automate the patent submission process. We also ended up getting involved in patent defenses as well, because our database was the system of record for collecting sequences and when certain inventions were discovered by HGS. So it became an asset that we used. And one of the key things there that those in the audience that work with IT, I've always strived to be part of the company's product rather than a cost to be minimized. And this was really true with HGS, because we were delivering genome databases to our customers, that we were viewed as data, an asset for the company, and we were a differentiator for the company. And I now encounter a lot of settings where IT is certainly not viewed that way. They are basically often report up through finance. And every time I see that on an org chart that says that they're viewed as a cost to be minimized and not as an asset to be sold. And we definitely try to position our current products and whatnot to be part of the customer's customer should be interacting with what we deliver. Yeah. And that's been a key sort of guiding light in our business.
So let's talk about that. So how is BioT I come to be and where are you guys at today? What are you doing?
Sure. So once we had reached a certain level of maturity at HGS, I decided it was time to move on and worked out a nice equitable arrangement with HGS and decided to start another business. Recall that I started with HGS as a consultant because I had owned a business after leaving Martin Marietta. And so I was comfortable with the uncertainty associated with launching out on my own. And it was clear that in my mind, those early HGS days that were entrepreneurial, fast growing, didn't know what tomorrow was going to bring, was the kind of thing that I would love to replicate if I could again. And so we started offering a service to biotech companies that in some ways emulated the kind of things that we built in-house at HGS, a comprehensive enterprise approach to collecting, analyzing, understanding, and reporting the information that's used for these biotech companies to develop their product. And so we started out, but I say we, it was me initially, but several of my HGS colleagues joined the company over time. And so we formed this core group, and we basically are still the core informatics group from HGS of the old days, and we've been together all those many years. So that's been very fulfilling. It also means that we understand each other extremely well, and there's very clear communication, and we can cover for each other extremely well. So it's really the amount of work that we can accomplish in a unit of time is really quite impressive, because we know what we've built. We know where we're going. We've seen certain things. We've got a certain kind of guiding star in terms of how we approach problems and apply ourselves to what the customer is doing.
So tell us a little bit about BioIT's One Platform 4 and how do you help your customers today?
So the evolution of BioIT was as we started out as consultants. So we didn't actually raise any money from outside investors whatsoever. So we're completely, to this day, 100% bootstrapped by the small investments that we made to get ourselves launched. And then we managed to pay ourselves back through consulting revenues pretty quickly. So as we worked with multiple companies, including the experience we'd taken forward from HGS, we started to see certain patterns or abstractions emerge. And we started bundling those into a platform, which we now call our One Platform 4. So it's a way we've kind of encapsulated our knowledge about how biotech companies work into a suite of tools. I often describe it as being very similar to the platform that Salesforce offers for a completely different vertical market. Salesforce knows about customers, they know about opportunities, they know about how opportunities move through a pipeline. Well, our entities are biomaterials, samples, reagents, and laboratory workflows about how those materials get combined together in order to go through a sample prep, data acquisition, and analysis kinds of workflows. And we've abstracted ideas out of that so that we can model many different material types, many different workflow types very rapidly in this platform. So it offers us this hybrid that I don't really see elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. You've got the one idea that companies go out and they go buy point solutions and they worry about lashing them together after the fact.
Yep.
Or you've got the in-house with all of that, the problems associated with, yes, you had this brilliant engineer, but they left the company and now I'm stuck with this albatross. Or I'm not willing, we're not a software engineering company. We can't invest in this. So what we do is we offer the customizability of the in-house approach with a robust delivery system that you would expect for a commercial application. And so we think this works extraordinarily well in biotech because these new companies are always doing something differentiated from
right.
The
so
last
it's everyone
one.
A little bit different. So you're going in there yeah. and you're helping them with their process and
exactly.
taking that process, translating it to your configuration, and giving them a very highly customized solution for them.
Exactly.
But
exactly
in a very, from a software quality perspective, a very out of the box, configurable, just like we would be able to do with anything else that we kind of buy today.
Yes, yep. exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's very much a customer first kind of approach. And we really have built it upon a couple of different sort of design objectives or certain characteristics we want in the solution, right? We want the solution to be adaptable. So we want to put something in place, even if we don't know what holds tomorrow, mm-hmm. new instruments, new technology, new direction for your product. And that's a real trick, but this was a trick we had to learn on the fly at HGS because we were building research systems, but we didn't know what direction the company was going. And we were quite successful at pivoting our activities to take advantage, and everything was an extension off of our core approach. And we didn't, and we were quite successful and happy with doing it that way. Mm-hmm. So that's a major advantage in that the rigidity that you see often in some of these solutions that once you get them configured, they get kind of locked down. We have opted for approaches that allow us to make changes in a very systematic way that are verifiable and validatable, and to be able to deploy those. So that experience of working with scientists, not knowing all the requirements up front, but allowing our system development to help raise those requirements to the surface mm-hmm. Has been a hallmark of the approach that we've taken. And really, we get great efficacy once people understand what we offer and embrace mm-hmm. what we're doing. And so we've done a lot of creative things. We've had good success in markets, for instance, that are relatively new, things like cell therapy and gene therapy, because there's not a large set of established solutions. And as new vendors are entering the market, they all have a twist on how they do it. So they're not all using the same approach. And so there is not an easy, obvious, off-the-shelf alternative, but you don't necessarily want to build from scratch anymore.
Yeah. Hmm. So let's talk about why this is all really super important. And I know you and I were talking the other day about the AstraZeneca J&J news and production issues yeah. during the COVID vaccines. And so why don't you share some of your thoughts about.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was obviously shocking to see a mix up in essentially raw materials that went into these vaccine batches that didn't get trapped at the point of use, but, you know, yay for the quality people for not letting it out the door.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it, to me, points to a potential flaw in the way the manufacturing is done and not taking advantage of some of the modern techniques that we might use. Mm-hmm. So we've been engaged more and more with manufacturing companies, and the way we would engineer something like that to help those companies is that the bill of materials would all be online. When you put together your batch records and you dispense the materials, there would be a verification step, including a barcode, that if indeed there was a mismatch between the barcoded item that you're trying to use right now and what is expected based upon the approved batch record, it would get flagged right away, right? So we look at this stuff and say, you know, it would take multiple concurrent mistakes
right.
under our architecture or sabotage to
get
yield
to,
the result
yeah.
that we were seeing there, right? And we often really work very closely with customers to try to optimize that experience anytime materials get transferred from one step to another.
Yeah. So one part of what you're also saying is that it's that process engineering, right?
Yes,
and that upfront
exactly.
analysis and requirement gathering and really understanding what is happening when and where and by who,
yeah.
what part of the process is truly systematic versus what is having to be done manually or entered manually. And so take me through that, because I know your team spends a lot of time and you guys are some of the best in doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one thing is that we, in working with our customers, we try not to just model the process as they built it, but to work collectively with them for a new, better process. That we try to.
I like that. A new
implement.
Better, right? Like that is the, it's hard, right? Because it's as a consultant coming in and kind of There's egos and there's other things at play, and you kind of say, well, that might not be the best way to do that. Or, you know, can reevaluate that. And getting that message across, I know for me, sometimes it's, you know, there's multiple, positions in the room too, right? You have QA, you have regulatory, you have IT, you have business, and they all have different objectives, right?
That's right.
And we as the consultants are coming in to say, hey guys, we know your part's important and your part's important and your part's important, but how can we all best kind of see this new way, this new better, I like that, into getting to a better process, and that's reproducible, validated, and so forth.
Exactly. So, you know, the thing that I often find when people are tied to those spreadsheets is that they've constrained their thinking to the to that two-dimensional grid that you've got, right? And we want to build a model that's much richer than that. Mm-hmm. We find that the data has a natural description to it. And, you know, in clinical trials, it's fairly easy to see. You've got a trial, you've got a site. Sites have subjects. Subjects have different time points over time, and then at each time point, there's a certain amount of activities or samples collected and whatnot, and then there's a certain set of tests that are performed, right? There's this really rich amount of context that is carried with every operation, and so it's one of our objectives is that when you're performing a unit operation somewhere, you are at the head of purification, that what you see when you come to your dashboard in the morning is here's all the cell culture batches that are waiting purification, and you can transact those, and you're never transcribing a lot number. You're picking it and moving it over, and then there's a sequence of steps where data is collected and operations are performed. Once you've got your purified batch, you then specify these are the tests that need to be performed, or maybe we know that which tests are performed based on the type of material you're creating, and that turns into test requisitions that each one of the labs sees. So this linkage is much better than what I see with some other approaches where someone has to manually think about when there's a transfer of materials, what is the appropriate lot number? We try to really make it so that there's very little chance for error.
Yeah.
That you're making a conscious decision, but you're transacting it here. And all of the information is essentially inherited. And when it comes towards the end of the process, you want a trace tree and you want to look back on where things are. It's beautiful because this thing was assembled organically as all these unit operations are performed by different people in different labs. And it all comes together very nicely.
A true chain of custody, right? And so, and that is something that, is really needs to be mapped out over different parts of the organization. I know you've worked with some that then have like multiple labs and all this information, and you have to do kind of your data warehouse thing and collect all of it, massage it all, and then figure out how to do it. But that chain of custody is super critical, right? And having that visibility into all the parts so that, to your point, if there's checks and balances that are systematic throughout the process, it should be a done deal at the end of the day, right? There should be very little error in that end-to-end process if it's done correctly.
Yes. And it supports our objective of visibility. You get to see all up and down the supply chain, what got assembled together, what test results were associated with the intermediates, with the final product. And again, this idea of us liking to be part of the product. Typically, if you're in a biomanufacturing context, you have a certificate of testing or C of A, certificate of analysis. That thing we want to produce, right? This is the, you know, to us, your system isn't complete. And we would then extend it so that the e-signatures and the reviews and approvals and evidence of those reviews and approvals are captured as well as the data is captured. And so you've got this package that becomes this reference that when it's time to do your CMC or BLA, you've got this very rich reference that you can come back to and see how everything, you know, flows together. So when we think about quality in software, our emphasis is actually more upon making sure that this tight integration happens at the customer experience level, that we've reduced the number of errors, we've reduced the number of deviations, that we've reduced the sort of things that would be hard to discover later, and make it visible to all the stakeholders who need that. And that's not necessarily an emphasis on the mechanics of quality systems and formal validation and documentation, but much more emphasis on making sure that the customer's interaction with your system is very clear and error-free.
Right, because in this case, the customer is the lab analyst that's doing the entry or the doctor that is coming in to approve the clinical trial, right? Like,
absolutely. Right? Yeah.
So the customer here is not, I think people forget, like, who is consuming the data, right? And having that perspective in when someone's designing anything, right? To really know what is that end user experience. And I know in the agile methodology, right, we call it the product owner, but how often do we really have the right product owners in the room to make those decisions? And I think that's part of when you guys go into an engagement where you are small and nimble, right? Able to get some of those answers, I hope, to the right people.
That's right. And you know, consistent with total quality management practice, right? We view the interactions between the departments as sort of a customer supplier relationship.
Yeah.
There's some kind of order and order fulfillment type transaction that's going on.
Yeah. What do I need? What do you get? Right? Like it's a simple thing.
Yeah. But doing something that makes that clear and visible, right? There's this emphasis on clear specifications, right? So a specification is I've got this material that's ready to be purified. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the guy that's doing purification needs to know what's the material, what its priority is, you know, how much did you make, what were the conditions under the cell culture was made and whatnot, so that they can set up their purification runs. And so this idea of making sure that there's sufficient information in order to be able to do the transfers, as well as feedback. So the person who's sending the stuff can see, well, what's happened to my batch once I made it? Mm-hmm. And you can now look forward and see it's in process for purification. It'll be going on to testing and release soon. Mm-hmm. So what we find is that as we do more and more of this new biotech stuff, right, these procedures are getting increasingly finicky and complicated, right? The cell therapy thing is this real shock, right? We used to make lots and lots of chemical drugs in enormous quantities, all with a single batch, in a single batch release process. Similarly with antibodies, we scale them up, 10,000 liters, 20,000 liters. We make them in bulk.
Yeah.
We release them in bulk. We package them, freeze them down, and that's your stock forever. Turn that entirely on its ear. If you're a patient and I'm getting your blood and now I'm performing some kind of multi-step complicated manufacturing process in order to engineer your T cells and use that as the drug itself. So that switch, or at least that new option, is enormously information intensive and just throws your old style of thinking about what's a batch of drug on its ear. It's no longer you're building stock for enormous quantities. You are building a lot size of one, and it's just a whole different way to approach
one. And that also changes over time too, right? So this concept of precision medicine, right, it's going to be personalized medicine. It's ever changing. And so this trend and this way of thinking and having uniqueness to all of us, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's pretty exciting, right? It's like the sci-fi movies galore. Yeah, exactly. But that is what you're kind of helping in designing systems to be able to keep track of all that.
Oh, no question about it. Yeah, the whole precision medicine world is based upon the idea that I can look at my biomarkers and your biomarkers, and I've got enough precision, enough depth in terms of what I'm measuring that I can differentiate the two. Yeah. Same thing is true, your genome, my genome, whatnot. Right. And so the information burden, the ability to manage large data sets and whatnot becomes a critical success factor in those in this kind of business. And really that's an area, again, that we spend a lot of time in because we come with a combination of experience in biotech and in the information handling data science domain as well.
And when I hear you say that, things that really strike me is around the level of risk and understanding the things and the systems that you're developing, right, to help your customers do what they're wanting to do. And the level of risk around that is so much greater, right, and understanding because you are doing that single batch, right?
Yes, exactly.
Versus some of my customers, I'm still trying to get to scale back their understanding of risk for a learning management system or a test management system, right? Those two conversations shouldn't even be had in the same room, in my opinion, right?
Like, I think it's two
totally different things. And so, and obviously there's the companies that do everything, right? There's there's the, you know, from doing mobile apps to doing, you know, bulk drugs, right? So they have everything in between and the combinations of those things. But when we're getting down to understanding the true level of risk here, and how software quality really is a spectrum, right? And so being able to apply some of those principles, total quality management principles, risk-based principles, right? All of those things to the user requirements, right? To really understand what are those user requirements and what is the risk there and how can we address those? Because that seems like for every case.
So, you know, one observation that I've had over years working with scientists, right? Is that they are not, one, they're not adept at writing requirements or conveying them. And it's largely because they themselves don't know, especially if you get beyond what one individual is working on. So we've adopted an approach where we're extremely open and tolerant of not knowing the requirements up front. And this really flies in the face of IT orthodoxy quite a bit. But what we will do is we will prototype based upon what we understand the requirements, and then offer the ability to interact with something we've built. And our platform allows us to do this successive iteration kind of approach extremely flexibly. So what we do is we discover the requirements with the customer interacting with something that works. It's functional. May not be complete yet.
Right.
But that's fine because this is where they can now engage us in a much more specific fashion. And so what we find is that we start out doing some speculation about the design, but I would much rather put something in for them to interact with and get that interaction going, because the quality of the requirements that emerges from that is far, far superior than the blank whiteboard. Here, tell me what you want. Right? I'm a blank slate. Just tell me what you want. So we've adapted our approach so that we go through this extended requirements discovery. Now, not everybody's comfortable with this, but the ones who are, they get the job done faster than it would have actually taken them to write the kind of detailed specs that you often see. And there's a level of verification of those specs that the paper copy never had. So we're way ahead of the game by the time we get there. So then what we will do for those applications that require validation is we will use that as the baseline for a requirement spec. So we defer writing the specs from the old style up front. And then, because otherwise, as you discover changes, you're compelled to go back and change the spec and whatnot. And you get stuck in these kind of loops that are not terribly meaningful. But if we then take a working model and write our specs there and go through sort of a phase of hardening and performance optimization and whatnot, once we know the function is substantially complete, and it does indeed work for these people, that's a huge step in the right direction. So it's very hard for some customers to admit that they don't know the requirements to the level of specificity that most vendors are going to require, and to say, look, I would rather partner with someone who can help us discover what is going to work for our process with our people, using our terminology and using our technology. And so that evolution. Now, what we find is once we get the first app in there, then people point to it and say, I want something like that. Or can you extend it in this direction?
Right.
And then we get very precise guidance.
Right.
And indeed, we're no longer the designers. We're just executing that. And we just make sure that what they're asking us for doesn't really break any fundamental rules. Right. You know, you're not going to break our traceability and our audit trail and our other stuff that's just that's baked into the way we think. So that's the way we try to evolve these. So we're not so taken aback when you get some next generation instrument and all of a sudden it delivers the data in a whole different format and there's more experiments you can run and all of this stuff. And the form factor, you know, of how many samples can be run on the instrument has changed. We look forward to that because we've designed it so that with very simple marginal effort and cost, that's just something we can add to our assay catalog, define this new workflow associated with the new instrument, but it fits the data model and it now just starts contributing to this asset that you're building of all of your results.
So you've done some pretty cool stuff. I'm not sure if you can share a client's name, but I know you've done some nice releases in Boston, right? Didn't you do some cool stuff?
Well, there was a press release we just did on COVID where we developed a software tool for collecting diagnostics for at-home test kits. So the evolution here, and this we did get permission from the customer, and this is an operation called Lab Central. They were running a study because some of their tenant companies that work in this shared incubator kind of space were involved in COVID diagnostics, developing a home test. So they were running a study with their own employees to do this. And so they needed some ability to do some data capture. So we built the PCR workflow for them, which is sort of the gold standard that everything's compared against in COVID diagnostics. So then they started using the at-home kits, and we extended it so that we developed a mobile app. And this thing turned out to be really cool. There's a simple kit that employees take home. They take home maybe a dozen of these things, and it's got a label that we print on the outside that has a QR code. So the employee goes home, they swab themselves, take out the kit, they scan the QR code, it takes them to our mobile web app. It knows who they are because they've authenticated with a thumbprint, it knows the date and time, and it knows the kit number. We've got, voila, we got all the data that we need to start the transaction. There's 15-minute processing time. We even built in a little countdown timer so you can do that. And it does ask you, as per the study design, you know, have you been vaccinated? Do you have symptoms? Have you been exposed to COVID? This for half a dozen or so simple, mostly yes, no questions. Once you submit the answers, you let the 15 minutes count down and you take a picture. And then you score it. Do you see a line where it says C? Do you see a line where it says T? Yes or no? And that goes in. Now, if it's a non-negative result, boom, the lab manager gets a notification through email. Mm-hmm. So the beauty of our approach is, and then, of course, we can aggregate how many people were tested, when were they tested, how many positives, how many negatives. You can even look at individuals and see negative, you know, a bunch of negatives for 5 weeks and then a positive and three positives in a row. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, really cool. And it combines the advantage you have with a centralized test because you do have a central data collection operation, but the convenience of the at home. Right. So mm-hmm. you're not even going into the lab with a sample so in terms of stopping the spread, there are people that are very excited about this at-home test. But the problem is that it's got, in my mind, limited value if you're testing yourself at home, but that result doesn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. And so it's this wonderful hybrid that we built. So, you know, the interest in COVID testing has waned quite a bit with the vaccines mm-hmm. really picking up steam. But I'm sort of thinking that, you know, when the fall rolls around again, there may be some hotspots or might be some other uses for that technology.
Yeah. I mean, the concept, though, and all of that, I think is so well needed, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's probably other applications as well, right? So I think what COVID has been really on the positive side of COVID, yeah. I think that there's some of the technology that we've had to develop in order to overcome has been phenomenal. But also on the FDA approval side and challenging what and how fast we can get approvals, what data should be captured, how can all of that kind of be reviewed and organized in much more efficient ways. I think that it's challenged our entire industry to think differently, right? It was mm-hmm. definitely a disruptor, yeah. right? I think of
no question.
A disruptor of needed proportions, because I know many of us in life sciences kind of really struggle over the years of why does everything take so long? You know, all the overburden and really kind of pushing the envelope, at least in the software quality of really challenging what's needed and why is it needed and what is the risk to the patient, right? If it's not
exactly.
there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the controversy around these at-home tests is that, you know, are they a diagnostic or are they a screening test?
Right.
If they're compared to the standard of care diagnostic that's much more expensive and takes more than a day to run and whatnot, well, they don't stack up as well. Right.
Right.
It's pretty clear. But as an early warning sign, mm-hmm. you know, that maybe you don't go into the office today,
right.
that you've now got enough virus to be infectious, not just exposure, but enough to be infectious, that's potentially a very valuable tool in stemming the progress of a disease.
Well, I could also thinking like, you know, big stadiums and things like that, where you can get almost instant, you know, results kind of see. So like, did we just open this up and now we're a hotspot? Like, and, you know, like in a much broader implications, I think that could be potentially used there. So can we switch directions a little bit? Do you mind?
Yeah, let's do that.
So I know, so you've been, and you've led large organization groups, right? Like a CIO at Human Genome Sciences. And I know you and I have talked about how IT is changing within life sciences and sort of the struggles sometimes that I've seen as getting into consulting in that how and what decisions are made and where to spend money and what's important and how do we shift back to quality, I guess. And so what do you have some thoughts about that?
Again, you know, to me, the overriding concern is, can we help these customers do their job in a way that ensures a quality, timely, and efficient product delivery? And the emergence of the application is king kind of approach, where you go as a scientist and you go buy a graphing tool and you go buy something to manage your inventory in a freezer and you get something else for managing the testing workflow and whatnot, and a laboratory notebook, is one, it's convenient. You don't have to go through IT. You can sign up for all these services. They're available on the internet, but it does indeed contribute to the data fragmentation problem unless we're really thoughtful about where things are going. And does it make more sense to think about an integrated solution and approach early on in your life cycle? Because what's going to happen, you're going to see, is dissonance between the inventory that you're manually keeping in your inventory system and your test results. Well, how do those link together? And your ELN, well, how do I know that people are going to have the discipline to put in the lot numbers without entering mistakes and whatnot? I can just craft an experiment that's anything. And therefore, when I want to answer a fundamental question, here's a lot of material. What are all the test results that have been run? How do you know you're getting a complete answer? So thinking through some of those things prior to the rush to purchase kind of mentality and discounting the dissonance between the sites and the amount of work that goes in to reconcile that stuff is very common, I see, these days. And that's sort of the tide that we're trying to row against right now in working with companies, is to say, let's come up with a design and then make the decisions in the context of, here's where we're headed. So again, if we use the manufacturing context again, we're going to have to make the CMC and publish it and get it in there. And I'm doing work today that is going to impact how successful we are that 3 years from now. And so can we build this thing organically, but with a common design that really understands the trajectory, if not all the specifics? And that's actually where I got incredibly lucky at Human Genome. Because as you recall, our source material were sequences, and sequences came off of instruments, and we had access to those before the scientists did. So this was brilliant, because we already had an anchor for a unique identifier for each one of these 5 million cDNA clones that we had. And we could reliably find them, resequence them, supply them to scientists for additional scientific work, and do that repeatedly over and over again. And the scientists weren't only ours, but they were our subscribers. They were the Smith Klein Beachams of the world and the Synthalabos and the Takedas, who were subscribers to the HGS database. So we got very lucky there, because when I found after leaving HGS that, gee, not all companies work this way, and now I'm thinking maybe we should be one. Is this idea of systematic biology has not caught on to the sort of cottage industry mentality that bio has grown up with, right? You know, a couple of smart grad students with a senior researcher who applies for a grant kind of model, and you just house them all under one roof and with different specialties. And so, you know, we're certainly seeing some progressive companies, but that trend hasn't happened as strongly as I assumed. And I think to some reason it's been delayed because of the easy access to these cloud-based applications that you can sign up for with very low overhead. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you've got an ELN. Well, you've also got a data island you've just created. Mm-hmm. And if you are the only consumer of that data, fine.
Right.
But if you're in a company that now is going to take your results and do some additional work for it, then you may have created something that's actually a barrier to going to the next step.
Yeah, we have a lot. I mean, you know, people want us to integrate with lots of different things, but then not really understanding then what it is. And you might not be able to get all that data to talk in the same way that you need to, right? And not the island mentality is what I think.
Exactly. I think you can design for that. But you're right to say retrospectively that, yes, there's an API to this ELN. Yeah, but the problem is not technical. It's syntactic. It's semantic, right?
It's very
nuanced.
How can
I interpret what's there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the thing we used to say is that, you know, you may have a phone on your desk and I have a phone and we can talk.
Right.
But if you're speaking Russian and I'm in English, we're not communicating. Right. And that's the problem that we have is that the assumption is that if I can make a pipe between these systems, that's the integration problem. It turns out that increasingly that's the easy part of the problem. It's the semantic consistency that's lacking. And therefore, before, you know, as you're making decisions to ramp up your lab and to staff it and whatnot, is to having some sense of how that's all going to hang together is really important.
Yeah. One of the other things I know, having scientists be part of the solution is, I don't know, maybe because I'm just a scientist and I'm pretty biased on that. But like that critical thinking, that way of which kind of have to break things down in order to build them back up. And being willing, I think, to your earlier points around being willing to be okay with the fact that I don't have a requirement. And, you know, that is often that's an easy way for me to think because that's how I think, right? Like, where I'm constantly making experiments each and every day and then figuring out how and what the solution is as I go along, right? That's just kind of how I think. And I'm not sure how to teach that to others because I feel like it's a very comfortable and pragmatic way to get to the next step in a process, but not sure how to teach that or how to.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I have a similar approach as you've gathered. And you know, we often say that the scientific method is our scientists will do an experiment and they're very comfortable with that, evaluate the results, and then they will craft their changes to that experiment to do the next one.
Yeah.
And this is the way I view this requirements discovery package. Mm-hmm. And this is why I think we've had such good affinity in these highly scientific disciplines, is that we put together this prototype. I think of it as an experiment. Mm-hmm. It's a model. Mm-hmm. You interact with it and you can say, how close are we? How much did we miss the boat on this? Mm-hmm. Right. And so then that thing gets refined and we go through another iteration. And what we find through that process is that then the people we're interacting with get more and more comfortable at expressing in the terms of what we've already built, what's the next iteration? Mm-hmm. What do we need to extend? And that's where we get into this very virtuous kind of quick turnaround cycle that we really like because it's really exciting. You're building something new. You're really getting closer and closer to that ideal fit for those individuals that are impacted by that. And that's what we do with requirements discovery. Mm-hmm. So our requirements when we go into a contract are often very much objectives for what we want to do. It's more of scope than features.
Right.
Right. What is the sandbox we're playing in? Where are the boundaries? And then make something work that has these characteristics. And that's the requirement.
It's interesting what you're saying, because it makes me think what you were saying about as you've done this through and your process with your customers, you come to a workable solution or an MVP, if you will, right? And they're using it. And then they come back to you for those point features. I want this extension. I want this new module, right? I want this. And so I was just reflecting on that also speaks to the maturity of those solutions for those individual companies, right? Like, so Do you have a sense of some of their maturity? Like, are they super low on the maturity scale? And then as you work with them, they've grown?
Yeah. Okay. So one of the stories I like to tell is when I was fairly new in the biotech business in the CIO role. I had a senior colleague, actually at another company that was one of our customers, and he expressed it this way about the cultural difference between research and manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, if you're a research scientist and you do the same experiment and yield the same result and you do that over and over again, you get fired. Mm-hmm. You're not discovering anything new.
I like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you're in manufacturing, you do this, you run the same lot under the same conditions and you get the same result. You are a winner,
yep.
Right? This is the key to success. So that is the essence of the cultural bridge that we try to work with our customers to help them along. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, part of my experience in HGS is that we were quite advanced in research tools. I thought that was going to carry over with no effort at all into what I think was a simpler problem space, you know, clinical trials and whatnot. Everybody's been doing this for a while, manufacturing. We can master that. And it actually turned out that these cultural differences became a real hurdle to overcome and to understand. And I just certainly didn't appreciate it my first time through. Mm-hmm. But now that we've been on both sides of that fence, mm-hmm. you know, we can then help act as a guide as companies are going through there. And yes, there is this idea that research needs a level of flexibility because their objective is to identify a new thing that's not currently on the radar.
Right.
But once you have that, then somehow we have to twist your thinking to, well, now I've got a lead product. I need to optimize. I need reproducibility. I need testing. I need safety. Right.
Yep.
And so all of these things, I need more documentation because I've got, you know, the goal of putting this thing in a human. So what we try to do is maintain a level of flexibility, but not everything that a researcher has,
right.
But a way to then craft your process development activity so that you can still make a lot of changes and see the effects of those changes. But we're already starting to introduce some discipline around bill of materials and test definitions and audit trails and traceability. And so those kind of concepts that really just don't get a lot of airtime in the research world. Mm-hmm. So that's very difficult for our customers to do. So in the sense of your maturity scale, it's sort of this idea of, is there an on-ramp to getting to kind of a FDA compliant kind of practice? That's absolutely
the goal,
a space that we're working in. And we're finding, you know, it takes some give and take. And even then, when we get at the end of that, sometimes quality people aren't terribly comfortable with the approach we've taken to get there,
right.
Because we didn't follow some of the orthodoxy around how you develop requirements and whatnot, as I've said. But we're finding it's a hybrid that has a lot of affinity. It works really well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we're hoping that more people will catch on to that.
Cool.
And
that's great.
And take advantage of what we can offer.
So as we wrap up here, tell me some of the things that BioIT is wanting to do in the future. You have some plans?
So there are a couple of trends that I think, you know, we'll see continue into the future. I mean, one thing that we saw with the pandemic is a lot of customers pivoted, and it turned out that demand for our services really spiked fairly quickly for two reasons. One of which is that some of our customers who spend a lot of time in the lab, well, they're at home 2 days, 3 days. And so they were actually engaged with our systems and asking for changes and whatnot. So we had a bolus of work associated with just being able to run our lab effectively with a skeleton crew that's on site and the other people are off site. And then, of course, some of our customers were engaged in therapeutics or diagnostics technology or vaccine technology. And so we managed to get some business that way. I think into the future, people are going to recognize that that kind of flexibility that they were forced into is something they're going to want to bake into future thinking. So I'm hopeful that that will have a positive effect for us. I definitely expect to see more international and regionally diverse companies that are getting into the BioIT fold. Mm-hmm. We're certainly seeing evidence of that. And we've got our feelers out in Asia, and we've got several key customers in Europe now. The other trend that we're seeing is this virtual organization trend, where someone else is doing the work. You've got a manufacturing contractor, you've got a CRO that manages your clinical trials, you've got a biobanking vendor that's handling your clinical samples, you've got a specialty lab, and these things are popping up all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so companies are less willing to invest in the technology to bring those assays in-house, so they are using this network of specialty labs. We're finding that our toolkit works really well at trying to converge and create a consolidated view of these data that are actually outside the organization, mm-hmm. right? So whereas much of our work used to be in-house labs, mm-hmm. LIMS, data management, instrument capture, now it's a hybrid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do some assays, but we also send the materials out here, and I want to see those data mm-hmm. in the context of patient and trial and time point. And that's quite a challenge. And a lot of companies are seeing that it's helpful to have someone who has some skill in the area of data integration, system integration, and has a data model mm-hmm. that this goes into so you can do your analytics and tracking.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike, it's always a pleasure, and I always learn something when we chat, and I want to do it more often. So I'm hoping I'll get up to Rockville soon, and we will have lunch, and we'll do it again.
Well, I certainly appreciate the invitation to chat with you. This has been a delight, and it's great to see you again.
Great. Thanks so much, Mike.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Software Quality Today with Dora Gonzalez-Azevedo. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, tx3services.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please feel free to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe. Also, be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous episodes. You can also check us out on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter at TX3 Services. This has been a TX3 Services production. Join us next time for another edition of Software Quality Today.